This is the Ontology Summit 2012 Track 3 Challenge, Ontology and Big Data. The co-chairs are Mary Brady and Ernie Lussier. This is Thursday, March 15, 2012, Session 10. And I've got the slides up now. The introduction is going to be brief since we have a very busy schedule today. Slide 2. The mission for Track 3 is to identify appropriate objectives for an Ontology and Big Data challenge and identify the resources necessary to complete the challenge. So we're looking at many areas where ontologies may or may not be used at the current time to identify those areas which we can expand into. Slide 3. Basically, I'm going to skip over these quickly because of the time. It's just identify the problems is the first thing. And state objectives, identify advocates. And then we need to put together a team to do it. The National Coordination Office, one of the sponsors of this group, is interested in expanding ontologies, the semantic web, throughout the NITRD agencies in research and development, as well as other government agencies. So we have a major stake in doing this. Slide 5. Just a couple of examples of potential challenge goals. Increase the number of qualified personnel to facilitate the growth of ontology technologies. Accelerate agencies' adoption of semantic and ontology capabilities. The government has a reputation of taking a long time to adopt new technologies. One number I heard is like 17 years, and I've never been able to validate that number. The process, we're looking for those challenges that can that will benefit the government. And as I said before, this is repeats the other graph. I'm going to skip over it. The panelists we have today are listed on the current chart. And Mary Brady is going to be running the meeting. She'll be doing the introductions for this group. Mary, if you want to begin.
I think we'll just, due to time, we'll just jump right in and we'll introduce as we go. Tim Finan is here to talk about making the semantic web easier to use and some of the work that's going on at UMBC. Tim, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Okay. Hi. Thank you for the invitation to talk today. It's been, I think, a couple of years since I participated in the Ontology Forum. Not because of lack of interest, but because I'm always feel like I'm overwhelmed with things. Anyway, I'm going to talk today on some research that's going on in our lab. This is done in conjunction with my colleague, Professor Anupam Joshi, and two of our PhD students, Harish Mulwad and Lushan Han. If you're interested in the PowerPoint version of these slides, there's a URL down in the lower right-hand corner of page 1. So moving on to page 2, this is sort of the overview of what I'll talk about today. Start out with two problems. One is that accessing or linked open data can be hard to create. The second is that linked open data can also be very hard to query. And by linked open data, of course, I mean RDF data that's interlinked as in the linked open data cloud. We have two ongoing PhD dissertations that are trying to address this. Harish Mulwad is working on the problem of trying to make it easier to generate linked open data from tables, and Lushan Han is looking at the problem of making it easy to query a linked open data cloud with a sort of a quasi-natural language interface. One reason why this impacts on big data is that both of these approaches that are being pursued need to compute a lot of statistics on large amounts of linked open data and possibly text corpora as well. So slide 3, I'll first talk about the first problem of Varisha's work. On slide 3, there's a link to a project page that lists a couple of publications if you're interested in some more information. So slide 4. Shows the basic problem. And I apologize, I forgot about the problem of trying to make sure there were no animations. So let me step through my animations. The basic problem is we'd like to take a table, table in a spreadsheet or a relational database or maybe even a table found on the web or in a document, and generate infer the intended semantics of the table and generate a linked data representation of it with respect to some set of linked open data resources. Barisha's working mostly with DBpedia to debug the ideas and the approach right now. DBpedia, of course, being the linked open data version of Wikipedia data. So if you look at this simple table, it's got four columns. It's got column headers, and it's got either strings or integers as cell values. What we'd like to do is, one thing we want to do is identify the semantic type of a column and associate it with a type in the ontology from one of the linked open data sources we're using as a reference. And here again, we're just using DBpedia for in the initial phase. So, you know, the type might be National Basketball Association teams. A second problem is that if you look at the first column, we'd like to identify some mentions of entities like Allen Iverson and link them up to a node in the linked open data cloud. A third problem is that we want to understand the relationships between the columns, the semantic relationships, deciding, for example, that the relationship between the first two columns is the DBpedia ontology team property that links a team player, a sports team player, to a sports team. And the final problem is shown, a final problem, and there are many more, is shown by the last column, where we want to interpret the numbers in that column as representing the height, probably, in meters of the people in the first column. Moving on to page 5, slide 5, shows what we might like the output to be in RDF linked data, where the strings that we've understood as being referring to entities or concepts have been replaced by their URIs. And we want to do this in as automated a way as possible. So moving on to page 6, Varish did an earlier version of this in 2010 that took a heuristic approach using machine learning. First problem was to predict the class of a column, and once that was done, he then tried to link the cell values, if they were strings, to entities. And then the third step was to identify and discover possible relationships between the columns. We found that this worked fairly well. In terms of class prediction, he was able to do this with about a 77% accuracy, more accurate for people and places and less accurate for organizations and other things. And for entity linking, he also got fairly good results, 66 on the average. But the accuracy left something to be desired, and we thought that the main problem was that it was done sequentially. So we predicted the class columns and then tried to link up the cell values and then tried to discover relationships. What we wanted to do in a more principled way was to tackle this same problem using joint inference and hopefully increase the accuracy of the results. So page 7 kind of shows the overview of our current approach, which still is domain independent. We take a look at the table with or without column headers, looking at the cell values, and try to come up with a joint assignment inference model. And we rely on a couple of knowledge bases. One is we rely on the linked open data cloud. Another is resource we rely on is a special knowledge base we call Wikitology that is grounded in Wikipedia. And as we extend this to domains beyond DBpedia, we'll need perhaps some custom databases for the domain. One of the use cases we have is being able to interpret tables from articles, medical articles from medical journals. So that would certainly require a specialized medical knowledge base going beyond what's available in the linked open data cloud. I won't go into the details of our joint inference model. It's still a work in progress, but we do have some initial versions that are described in papers that are listed on the linked to on the project page that was on that third slide, I guess. So moving on to page 8, I just wanted to illustrate one of the interesting problems that Varish is tackling and suggest how it can be approached in a more interesting way with linked open data. And that problem is if we have a column with just numbers in it, and again, we may or may not have a column header, but if we have a column header like population with numbers, well, suppose we don't have the population header, and we just have these numbers, 690,000, 345,000, so forth. We don't know a priori if these are populations of cities or countries or profits in thousands of dollars or what. So we're looking at various approaches to predicting properties based on the cell values. And one thing we realized is that, say, DBpedia, for example, has a lot of interesting knowledge we can mine. I recall that Psych had common sense knowledge about values. For example, it knew that human beings' typical ages range from 0 to 100, and maybe nobody lives past 120. And I think this was, a hand-coded fact. We can mine that information from DBpedia. DBpedia has a class of living people. We can look at their ages. Ages are known for many of them, and come up with not just a maximum and a minimum or an average, but a distribution. And in particular, for various subclasses of people, like professional athletes or politicians, we'd expect to find a different distribution than one for just living humans. So there's a lot of interesting knowledge we can mine from linked open data that would help solve this particular problem as well as others. So that's sort of an overview of one of these problems. And again, I guess I'd like to point out that solving this problem does require processing a large amount of data. Some of it would be from domain text to understand the similarity between different words and phrases, and other processing would be on linked open data, in our case itself, to discover the similarity between similarity of association between entities and also types of entities, so that we can better predict relationships between the columns, for example. So I'll move on to page 9, which begins the second project I wanted to talk about. This is almost the inverse of the first problem. It's developing a better system that we can use to query something like a linked open data cloud. And this is research by our PhD student, Lushan Han. Moving on to page 10, slide number 10, here's how we see the problem. DBpedia and linked open data in general has a very nice query language, but querying it requires a lot of the user. For example, the user has to understand the RDF model, has to master Sparkle, a formal query language. But more significantly, the user has to understand the URIs or the names for a lot of ontology terms. Just in the simple DBpedia ontology, there are, I think, about 320 classes and over 1,600 properties. And it matters even worse if you want to refer to a particular individual like Barack Obama. In DBpedia, there are over a million such entities, and it's very difficult to remember what the URIs are. And there's also a problem that there are terms that, just judging from their names, are very similar, and you don't know which one to use. So DBpedia has a place concept, and it also has a populated place concept, and it's not clear to the average user what's the difference. So, our idea is that querying a large linked open data resource or a collection of linked open data resources is going to be overwhelming for an ordinary citizen or even a specialist who's not, very intimately familiar with the ontologies. Well, one solution is natural language, a natural language query system, a question answering system, but this is still a research project, and such technology is not quite ready to turn loose on the world, we think. So slide 11 shows the pragmatic solution that we're trying to explore. So the goal is to allow users with a basic concept of RDF as a kind of a graph database to query a linked open data collection. We would like that such a system to be easy, accurate, and fast. And the key idea that we're using to perhaps make this possible is to reduce the complexity by first having the user not enter a natural language query, but enter a simple graph drawn with a graphical user interface. And then second, to annotate the nodes and arcs in that graph with words and phrases. So slide 12 shows a simple example of a query that a user could enter. The user might be interested in knowing where the person who wrote The Adventures of Tom Sawyer was born. Draws a graph with three nodes, and each node represents an entity, and the links between them represent a binary relationship. For each entity, the user can specify two things. One, and that we show in the top part of a node for an entity, is something that either suggests the name of the entity or a mention of the entity, or something that shows it's an output variable we're interested in with a question mark, or an output variable that, or a variable that we're not interested in seeing in the output, a star. So, for example, the node on the left represents some. Oh, the second thing in each node is a word or phrase that represents the type of thing. Place, person, or book in this example. So we think that this kind of interface might be easy for a user to understand, and, you know, with a little bit of information about how RDF data is organized. And it does give the user complete freedom to use natural language terms and phrases to describe types of entities, classes of entities, and relations, and also names of things. So slide 13 shows what we do in the first part of translating this into a SPARKL query. What we do is for each node and for each link, we compute the semantic similarity of the phrase, so phrases in the text associated with the node or the link, with terms in our ontology that is the target. So what we do is we take the ontology terms, and we tokenize them, and we stem them, and we have a metric for the semantic similarity that you can see in this example. And the similarity is based on a couple of things. We're using on text distributional similarity. We're also using latent semantic analysis and WordNet. One thing you notice is that some of the ontology terms for relations and concepts are pretty accurate, and some of them are far off. If you look at, for example, BornN, the most likely relation that is suggested is cylinder bore, and that's a result of a problem in the stemming. For BornN, we came up with a stemmed version bore, and you know, this then was you know, mapped into a cylinder bore as well as to you know, birthplace and birth name and so forth. So moving to slide 14 is just another example. This shows a more complicated query, and we can handle queries with better our graphs with cycles. That's not a problem. The query, graphical query on slide 14 might be paraphrased as football players who were born in the same place as their team's president. And it kind of shows the power of having a underneath a real query language and not just doing something like IBM's Watson sort of system. Slide 15 shows the next step, which is once we've come up with these lists of concepts and relations from the ontologies that might represent each entity in the query graph, we need to select from among them to come up with the best interpretation. And here, we're relying heavily on statistics of the data. So we've taken, in this case, the data from DBpedia and computed a lot of statistics about it. One of the primary measures we're using is point-wise mutual information between RDF terms in the LLD collection. And we're doing this across entities, but also across types of entities. And so this is basically a measure of the degree to which two RDF terms or types occur together in the knowledge base. We find a strong association, for example, between actor and film, actor and play, and maybe a weaker association between actor and birthplace. So in a good interpretation, the ontology terms will associate in a way that the corresponding user terms connect in the semantic graph. Slide 16 then shows for that simple example that we selected concept we selected for each node and for each relation in that simple query. And then if we move on to slide 17, we see the final step, which is to take that understanding and to produce a Sparkle query. So our notion is that that Sparkle query can just be run to produce an answer, or it could be reused in some way. Perhaps a user is a knowledge engineer, or somebody wants to take that query and put it into their system, or take that query and adapt it in some way. Slide 18 shows results of a preliminary evaluation we did on this. What we did is we took 33 test questions from a challenge that was put forward for the workshop on question answering over linked data at last year's Extended Semantic Web Workshop. These questions were natural language questions that could be answered with DBpedia. What we did is we had three human subjects who were initially unfamiliar with DBpedia and the semantic web translate those natural language test questions into our semantic graph queries. After a short 15-minute introduction to what the semantic graph queries were like, we then took their semantic graphs and put them into our system and computed the precision and recall and F measures of the answers. These were compared in this slide with two very good natural language question answering systems, Power Aqua and True Knowledge. And our system, which is in the first row, Go Relations, compares very well to these natural language quest systems, achieving better precision, better recall, and better F measure. It might be expected because our problem is quite a bit simpler by introducing this structured graph, but that's the point. We think that with taking this approach, we can build a tool that for the next 5 or 10 years might be preferable to a natural language QA system because those are still under development. Slide 19 has a URL in it, and this is a URL to the preliminary version of the system without really a good user interface, but which you can use to experiment by putting in queries against DBpedia. And you can also look at some of the sample queries examples that we have. You can see some of the things that are going on underneath the covers. We produce many possible interpretations and then select from among them, and we have various ways of adjusting the interpretations. So we'd be happy to have people try it and give us some feedback on it. Slide 20 is the final slide of this overview presentation. Just some conclusions. We think that the linked RDF linked data is an important emerging paradigm for sharing structured and semi-structured data. And if it's not RDF linked data, it might be something very similar, like perhaps the microdata format or something else, Freebasis format. However, querying these systems generating data for them from, say, tables are still something that is difficult today. And the main problem is that the schemas for these representations are just too large, and they have too many terms for entities to make it easy to do manually. So we think that there's a new set of tools that can do the automatic mapping of tables to linked data and the automatic mapping of this simple, it's almost a query by example kind of interface to linked data that might be helpful. That's the end of my presentation, and I do have to leave in a few minutes. I apologize for not being able to stay around, but I will be able to stay for a little while.
Thank you, Tim. Before we move on, can I just remind folks, Peter has pointed out that there's 10 folks who are on the conference call but not in the chat room. If you go to the webpage for the conference call and under conference call details, there's in-session chat, please go ahead and join the chat room as well so you can see the conversation that's going on. Tim, you have to leave, I guess, in the next couple of minutes.
Oh, I can stay about another 10 minutes, I think.
About another 10 minutes?
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, we're not going to have time for questions. We normally hold questions until the end. Are you on the email list?
I am, yes.
Okay, so I will, if you all would like to post questions to the chat room, we'll make sure that they get on the email list so Tim can address any questions. And I guess in the meantime, for the next 10 minutes, I suppose you could participate in the chat room conversation.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Okay, our next presenter is Dr. Kim, who has graciously agreed to join us from Japan, where I think it might be in the middle, of the night in Japan. Dr. Kim, are you ready?
Yes. My name is Kyung Soo Kim, and I'm a researcher of NICT in Japan. So I'm very honored to have a talk here. And today I would like to introduce some application scenarios based on the cyber physical data cloud computing. So today's presentation is much more conceptual, the presentation better than the technical work. So the slide 2, this is the concept of the cyber physical data cloud computing. So recently, our laboratory started the collaboration with NIST to develop a data cloud platform specialized for the managing the cyber physical data. So based on the cloud computing environment, we are planning to collect and archive a various type of the sensing data from the physical and the social spaces, for example, Twitter or some environment sensing devices, and try to get some knowledge of the real-world situation from the big and the diverse the sensing data. And then finally, we think about the deliver some actionable information to the real world, for such as the human rights, even though the machine and can use the, some information. And page 3, this is our technical goal is of the cyber physical data cloud computing. So we think that the cyber physical data cloud computing is to place a lot of the interconnect between the physical and the cyber world, and then finally to realize some real world awareness computing. So we defined what is the real world awareness computing. So we defined the real world awareness computing is on some intelligent cloud computing to autonomously support the useful the data or information, even the knowledge services, by being aware of the relationship between the elements in the real world. So even though we think about some relationship between the object or event, even the situation, so I think it's more extension version of the situation awareness to consider about relationships. And so to understand the real relationship, such as the semantic or association or some collaborations among the object and event, is very the most important part for the real-world awareness computing. So we are designing some functionalities of the cyber-physical data cloud computing, and then also we designed some cloud system architectures. And we defined the four interaction, especially the observation and then perception and action is communication, is the main activity of the cyber-physical data cloud computing. So for each interactions, we want to develop some the functionality and then system functionalities. And then the page four is the overview of our collaboration work between NIST and the NICT. We think about the four timers. So firstly, we want to develop some cyber-physical social data cloud infrastructure. And based on the infrastructure, we think about some standardizations and then test bed and then applications. So especially today, I would like to share some application scenarios based on our cloud platforms. So the page, the slide five, we considered some application topics. For example, smart healthcare or smart disaster information, and smart city, and then social life, the network. And then we picked five features required for the cyber-physical data cloud. So first, an application system would be decentralized. So it means everything is not only the system or data is distributed, and then they coordinated each other. And the second is, it is the ad hoc systems to adapt to new situations. So for example, data integration or service discovery or service composition, it should be ad hoc. And then the relationships is maybe valid for a certain time. So it's very dynamic system. And then the third is the relationships. I think here we are lots of challenges to find the relationship over the big and then especially the heterogeneous sensing data. And then the information and then functions of the applications would be provided by considering those relationships. And then I think that the system acts differently according to the level of the measurement of the relationships. So even though the situation is given, but system is locally or globally, they are reactive. And then finally, the system autonomously reacts by being aware of local and global circumstances. So this five feature is where we want to focus on. And then the slide six. So let me show some example scenarios. First, we take the healthcare data publish and the sharing. So there's the use cases. For example, we had the Great East Japan earthquake on March the last year. So at that time, the lots of the hospital were disappeared by the tsunami. So many patients had to move to the other the hospital. But there was no healthcare record about the new patients. So it could, it's difficult to start the treatment as quickly. However, some certain hospitals, they shared their record with each other. So as a result, so the patients could restart their treatment without the overlapping examinations. So from this experiments, the Japan government and the society are getting interest in the cloud computing and then start to share the healthcare data on the cloud. But however, still we have some problems because they usually assume the preserved sharing. So it means the sharing contraction should be the preconditions. And then based on the contraction is assumed and the application create global the schema to cover the whole users. So it means the system already difficult, the need to more time to adapt the new situations if that we cannot expect the some situations. But disaster usually occurs lots of the exception cases. So at the time we much more difficult to reconfigure the system or reconfigure the system. So we want to solve these problems and then we try to support five of the features, for example, decentralized or ad hoc, or relationship based the function, the system. And then we also want the autonomous activities of the system. And then we have the slide 7. We have the other use cases. We called available the location based services. So especially based on the disaster experience. So at that time, the last year, the earthquake, and then the three questions is very important. First is, am I the dangerous? And then how can I escape the dangerous area or situation? And then the outside of the area of the earthquake area, so many people want to know where is my friends or where is my family. So we categorize the location-based services. So one is the geofencing and the geo-advertising and geo-Q&A. So there is a lot of the location-based services, but currently location-based services is usually focused on to provide some point of interest information. So we want to extend the current location based in the services to have the new functionality. For example, automatically checking some service when they entered some disaster or event or favorite the place, and then automatically or partially shared their location information. And then, I will explain this scenario more detail using the next slide. So the slide A is we focused on this function. So globally monitoring, and then we want to add the locally fencing. So currently in Japan cases, currently we have a lot of the alert applications to provide the earthquake warning or some tsunami warning services. But usually it's text messages, so the people just they have to decide the next activity. But it's really difficult to how to say, difficult to decide it because, for example, Tokyo is very big area, so it's very difficult to understand where exactly the dangerous area. So we want the provide to using the some how to say warning message, and then warning message contains some geographic information, geographic specific geographic information, and then we want to broadcast the location the warning information to the user. In this case, we think about the smart user, a smartphone user, and then if the smartphone get some this alarm message, and then smartphone it can calculate the user whether user is danger or not because of the message contains the geographic information system, geographic information. So if the only user, I mean the only the smartphone of the users inside of, I mean high level of the dangerous, they react the day against of the tsunami event, the alert information. And then in this case, we want to use some social network to report the their location information to share to give the answers, where is my family or where is my friend. Even though the many companies, they have the location information, but the privacy policy, the problem of the privacy policies, we cannot use geolocation information, especially location information of each user. But if a user can report their information to using the social network, that times we can maybe, it's much more possibility to use the location information. And then we monitor the social network to get and then detect some event information using the social network. And then we can generate the new the event information to support the next steps. For example, the navigation or some shelter monitoring systems. But the problem is in this slide, I draw the many errors to represent the relationships. But how can we find this kind of relationship, and then how can we use this relationship to aggregate the relevant, the many kind of sensor data? So it's very difficult. I think it's very difficult to find this kind of relationship, and then how can we find the relevant data set, I mean sensing data. So usually the disaster cases, lots of the exceptional or lots of new situation is happen. So I think the cloud computing, our platforms should be adapted even though the new situation is happens. So this now we are trying to develop our platform and this kind of the applications. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kim, for taking the time to present from the middle of the night over there in Japan. Next up, we have Mike Folk, who will be here to discuss HDFI, the hierarchical data format that's used in a number of scientific applications. The suite of technologies used widely in science and engineering for working with high-volume complex data. And in his presentation, he'll describe how HDFI supports metadata as well as data, and give us an example. Mike, are you ready?
Yeah, so I'm going to talk in this brief presentation about the HDF technology. You want to go to slide 2? There are really two topics. When I scoped this out, I ended up having a whole bunch of things to talk about and realized I needed to throttle back. So I'm just going to talk about how to think about HDF5 and what it is. And I thought that one topic that could be interesting And the reason I think that Alden Dima suggested I talk here would be the possible use of HDF5 as a triple store. Let's go to slide 3. So I'll start with that. Go to slide 4. So HDF5 comes out of the high-performance computing world. The original version of HDF was developed in 1987 at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. And then HDF5, which is like the second generation, despite the fact that it says 5, was released in 1998. And it's used in virtually every scientific and engineering discipline and in many areas outside of science and engineering. So it's very widespread for applications that deal with either high-volume data or complex data or some combination of those. Often heterogeneity is an issue. People have a lot of different types of things they want to mix and match together. As a format, HDF provides a lot of flexibility in how things are stored. So it's not just one size fits all. You can really adapt. It's a format that adapts itself to how you're storing things. And similarly, there's an I.O. library that adapts, that can do I.O. in different ways and can be written to do things in different ways. So it's quite flexible in that way. And we've also designed it so that, data can be stored in pretty much any kind of medium, and the software runs on virtually every system. Let's go to slides 5, 6, and 7 in succession. This is my animation. So if you have a lot of different objects that you're dealing with, different types of objects, for example, and you would like to have a sort of a container that would be able to encapsulate all of those together in a meaningful way, HDF5 is a potential solution, and that's one way in which it's used quite a bit, where people have to store a lot of different things, and typically some of those are big things. Let's go to slide 8. There are basically, depending on how one counts them, and for today I'm going to count them as 4, basic building blocks for HDF5. One is called we call the group, and it's basically represented by the folders in this picture. You could think of the group together with the links, the arrows there, as kind of going together. And they allow you to organize things within an HDF5 file. And actually, I say file, but HDF5 could actually be a collection of files that are all related. So sometimes we think of HDF5 sort of as a domain of information. But for simplicity, let's just think of things as being in a file. And then secondly are the data sets, and that's where, the data goes, as the name implies. Data sets sort of fundamentally are simply arrays, any number of dimensions from 1 on up. And they're designed, their structure and so forth is designed to handle large data objects. So an image, for example, and a very large image, like a half of a terabyte image. or normal size image. Attributes are just like data sets, except they're designed to handle small sort of data entities so for example, metadata is typically what goes into what we typically call metadata often goes into attributes. The elements of a data set or an attribute have a data type. So, they might be integers, they might be floats. But one of the things that we've really emphasized in HDF5 and we've done a lot of work on is the ability to support many, a very rich sort of collection of data types. So it's not just, integers, floats, and strings and so forth, but you can create rather complex record structures as a data type. And that turns out to be a very powerful mechanism and allows you to create these, you know, these arrays of types that can pretty much represent any kind of data that, that one wants to, either in a single array or perhaps in a combination of arrays, as we'll see in the next example. So let's go to the next slide. So that's kind of the basics of HDF5. We often refer to it not as a format, but as a meta-format, because it's, you know, it is a format, but it has these objects, and people use these objects to create things that are meaningful to them. So a user will create a format of their own based on using the HDF5 objects. So that would be their format, and in that sense, HDF5 is a meta format. Let's go to the next slide. In the next few slides, I'm going to take one example and kind of walk through what this means in terms of, you know, actually using HDF5. The NASA's Earth Observing System, which is the system that gathers, you know, data for understanding and studying global climate change, weather, and a whole bunch of other things, consists of a whole bunch of different satellites. Every satellite has, you know, one or maybe several instruments on it, and each instrument is going to collect various kinds of data. So just among the three primary satellites, there are something like 12 or 1,400 different data products. So what you've got is all of these different sorts of data coming out, and it's very important to be able to integrate that data to make it interoperable. So let's go to the next slide. So what NASA has done is they've created something called HDF EOS, the EOS for Earth Observing System. And they you know, kind of surveyed this data, and, you know, I have to say this is something that took several years to kind of come up with, but they kind of concluded that there were sort of three major types of data that they were looking at, and sort of three major structures into which they could convert most of the data that they were dealing with. There are some other smaller ones, but I'll just focus on the fact that there, you know, the idea that there are three. So let's go to the next slide. A swath, for example, if you imagine a satellite that's on a polar orbit and the Earth is turning in, you know, on its axis, and this satellite, as it's passing over the Earth, it's making these scans. So you've got these scan lines, which in terms of simply the layout of the data is kind of like a rectangle. But in terms of the location of the data, it's more like an S-shaped, rectangular thing. And it could have several layers and so forth. So let's go to the next slide. And so in representing a swath within an HDF file, they said, okay, we've got our data fields, so that will be the actual measurements that these instruments are making, but we've also got geolocation fields, which is the information that tells us about where each pixel or each measurement point was taken from what point on the Earth. So they had to pretty much gather that information together in one place. They call that a swath, and you can see how they used HDF5 here to kind of organize that data. I've left out a whole lot of details here, but this is a kind of a cartoon version of that. And then a similar thing was done with that, what was called the grid structure and the point structure. And then we can see that within a given HDF5 file, you might have several swaths. And the flexibility of HDF with the grouping structure and the linking and so forth allows you to mix and match things however you need to. You can add extra swaths later on. You can delete swaths, and you can mix swaths with grids and so forth. Okay, next slide. All that's nice in terms of HDF, but the last thing you want the user to have to do is to worry about how all these things are organized internally in an HDF file. It can get rather complicated. They would have to traverse this tree structure. They have to know what to look for, where the data field was, where the geolocation field was, and so forth. So let's go to the next slide. So instead, what they did, and this is very typical of the way that people use HDF5, is they created their own library, which are called the HDF EOS libraries, and those software libraries reflect to a user or to an application the earth science data types. So if an application is using HDF in the form of HDF EOS, they don't say, you know, how many data sets are there or what are the names of the data sets. They'll say, they'll be able to say how many swaths are there, or for this swath on this part of the earth, I want, you know, this subset of the data and that sort of thing. So that provides the view of the data, and that's a very common way that HDF 5 is used. A lot of users never realize that there's an HDF file under the hood. They're thinking of a HDF EOS file or something else. Another example of that is MATLAB. MATLAB uses HDF as its underlying format, but most people are not aware of that. It's just a MATLAB file to them. Next slide. So what then happens is the applications, the Earth Observing System applications, of which there are thousands, and then tools like MATLAB, which also has an understanding of HDF EOS, IDL, and so forth, are written on top of that library. So these four layers are very common in the use of HDF. Okay, next slide. Okay, now I want to just talk in the remaining couple of minutes that I have about this idea of HDF5 as a triple store to sort of relate it to you all. Next slide. There are really only three kind of points that I would like to make. One, and this is what Alden said to me, you know, yeah, I talked to these guys because I think HDF might be an interesting possibility for a triple repository or something like that, whatever your term is. I mentioned the flexibility of HDF data types, that there were a lot of different possibilities there. And, you know, after talking to Alden about this, a colleague and I went off and we came up with several different representations that one might use for an RDF triple in terms of an HDF data type. And the point to be made is that, you know, it would be relatively straightforward to describe a triple in HDF5 terms, and then if you had, you know, a million or a billion or several, you know, billion triples to be able to handle the storage of that, and it might be possible, this is something that needs to be explored, to organize your structures. You know, you could build indexes and other sorts of things within HDF5 that would suit the kind of data that you were interested in, as well as the sorts of access that one needed to have. In terms of organizing for efficiency, there are a lot of little capabilities that I haven't talked about. For example, you can compress the data in an HDF 5 file. You can store it in different chunks. You can organize it in different ways. You can present different views to the data. All of these can lend themselves to efficient storage or efficient access or some combination of those. And then the third point in terms of enabling access is, you know, once again, one could decide how to store these things in HDF 5, but you'd want to do that based on, for example, looking at how Sparkle accesses data, how it needs to access data, how it needs to store it, how it needs to query it and search it and so forth, and you would want to organize it in a way that, that matched well with that. And in addition, you'd certainly want to build some sort of a layer or a library above that would, you know, speak to Sparkle, or that Sparkle would speak to in terms that make sense to it. So that's a brief introduction of HDF5 and some thoughts about one possible use of HDF5. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. In the interest of time, I just want to do a time check. It appears as though it's 1:40 now. So we have about 50 minutes left and three more presentations to go through. So I'd ask the remaining speakers to try to keep your comments to 10 to 15 minutes max. Next up, we have Mario Pellucci, who will tell us about the work going on in Future ICT, the Global Participatory Computing for a Complex World.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. So I can start. Well, first, thanks for Nicola Guarino, who sadly isn't with us in this moment, but he knows very well about the project, who invited me and gave us our chance to present the project to this audience. And this is a project created by a group, as you see from the first slide, of more than 1,000 supporters in a work that lasts for 1 year, and it's ending in April. The principal investigator is Dirk Helding from Zurich, and the coordinator is Stephen Bishops, which are the official representative. I am a participant of one of the five initial nodes. Some more contextual information that you will not find directly in the slides. This project was created in answer to a call of the European Union for large-scale projects, and the call was aimed to find some important research theme that would be met with a complex effort behind the usual timescale of such efforts. So what is interesting about this kind of projects is that they are created with a 10-year timeline, while in Europe we are usually accustomed to dealing with shorter projects on a duration of 3 years. So when the call went out, it was of course scientists are very fond of securing one line of research for so long. And it got many challengers, and we now are reduced to 6 projects, 2 of which will be selected. So the contextual information is, this is a preparatory work that we are doing in to prepare a proposal that will be judged in 2013, so we still have 1 year, and of 6 proposed projects with Future ICT is one, it might be selected, it's my notes. Of course, we much hope it as it will. So we can move to slide 2. And the starting idea of Future ICT is that of, let's say, techno-social system or socio-technical systems. As everybody knows, we live in an information age, and the global ICT, which spans the whole planet, is the most complex artifact ever created by humanity. In a sense, we are living in a mix of artificial social systems and human-created system. I think that this reflects also Kim's presentation. And an example, if you want to focus on one, is a computer-based automatic financial trading, which is a huge thing in the world today. It influences everyone's life, April, as we've learned recently, and is a complex structure created by humans for humans, but not much planned, but we let it emerge from an interaction. At the moment, we have too much data, too much speed, and too much complexity. ICT is part of the problem, but we also believe it is the key to the solution. So there is a need to understand social interactive systems, and Future ICT aims to answer this need by collecting essentially three forces. The basic is the basic one is ICT technology in all its versions and flavors. But future ICT leans on three legs, three basic disciplines. So we want to recover the connection with the social sciences, and my group is especially fond of this direction. So future ICT hopes to speak with the sociologists, the economists, also all disciplines that are not that don't find it very easy to interact with computational disciplines. So ICT on one side, social sciences on the other side, and the third side is complexity science. We can move to slide three. Next. So this again, the future ICT, that is again context, future ICT could create a European ICT paradigm which is different from the one that we are living in. You can look at the picture with the battle of the giants in the, for the control of the internet, and create a big data commons, which we, of course, as a public finance project, potential project, we are sensitive to ethical values and cultural feeling, culturally fitting ICT and privacy respect and data mining. We can move on here to slide four. To give an idea of what's the complexity part, why the complexity part is important. Well, we've all seen the prevalence of networks in research recently. Networking is good. The new way of connecting by web and its descendants helps us to connect with everybody, but also promotes cascading effects. Cascading effects are typically studied by complexity science, and so one of the more important components of future ICT is a connection with all the physicists and the complexity scientists that are experts in networks, in tipping points, in fluctuations, and in scale-free systems. So now we have a global exchange of people, money, goods, information, ideas, and our world is strongly coupled and interdependent. Network infrastructure help us, but also create pathways for disaster spreading. So we need to understand how these systems work. We need tools to keep the system away from the critical points in which the fall of a single drop can change completely the scenario. Imagine the famous sandpile. This is an official presentation for Future ICT. So we have an animation that I can show you here, but it's a set of balls that are unstable because they are set on springs, and when the last ball falls in place, everything explodes. Next. So as I was saying, strongly coupled, the complex system behaves fundamentally different from the system we are used to deal with. Here we have a couple of classic examples. We compare a power law distribution with a normal distribution, which is the kind of things that humans are good at dealing with, the normal one. Power law has a much higher risk because extreme events are much more frequent than expected. In fact, extreme events are possible while they're essentially not possible with normal distributions. So we have faster dynamics, increased frequency of extreme events of any size, as much as the system remains coupled, and self-organization dominates the system dynamics. Control of this kind of system is different, and the tools of complex systems are probably our only chance, our only bet to get some more control of this interconnected world that we are building. So there's a need for a change of perspective from a component to an interaction-oriented view, and a need for a science of multi-level complex system. Next. Here, I think a famous, one of the other obvious examples is traffic. By the way, that Dirk Helbing specialized the field, so he's been building traffic systems in Zurich, and here there are examples of system of agents, which all have a common objective, which is to cross the road intersection. And the result of their action is that no one is able to cross this intersection. So if you can't leave the solution to the individuals because the individuals are not able to coordinate in an efficient way, it's much better to change the framing of the problem. So if you create a different shape, you have a better chance to have the traffic jam solved. We can go to the next one. These are, as I was saying more or less in the beginning, are the ingredients that we want to collect under FuturiCT. As I said, we're trying to reach far and wide in the science domain. So we want connection to the humanities and to qualitative sociology, but of course the core of our connection will be with quantitative sociology and economics. The other important part is complexity science, and then there are the three new pieces of the puzzle, which are things that we are going to build in the FuturiCity project. And these are the global participation platform, which will be a platform dedicated to connection with everybody, and that's why there's the crowdsourcing level. A platform dedicated to big data, so data science, and we call it the planetary nervous system, and a platform that will be dedicated to helping social scientists to move to a fully computational approach, and this is what we call the Living Earth Simulator. All these things connected together form the core of the project. We can see it also in the next slide, I think. So we can go next. Yeah, this is a schema of the project as we think of it now. And since this has changed a lot in time, of course. You can imagine that an interaction like this that lasts 1 year, which we had plenty of meetings in person and virtual meetings, we had a lot of changes. But that idea now is getting more concrete. And in April, we are making the final proposal. So this is more or less the shape that it will take. You can see the three components very clearly here now, because you have the social-inspired ICT lower center, and you have the complexity science, and you have the computational social science. All these things contribute to build this innovation accelerator, which will have the three big components in green, which are the ones that I presented before. A living Earth simulator, which will allow computational social scientists to test new models, new ideas, basing them both on big data, which will be mined by the planetary nervous system, which is the big the green circle on your left, and all this theory should be validated and discussed with the public in general, with the global participatory platform, which is the green circle on the top. The other ingredients that you see in this map are the connection with specific fields, and we call them exploratory. There is currently a hierarchy of exploratories which contains more specific observatories, but anyways, these are the four main themes that we are building specific structure to look at them. These exploratories will benefit from all the functions of the platforms and the system, the global participatory platform, the planetary nervous system, and the living Earth simulator. Around the circle, you will see all the other interesting ingredients. I will not go into it them all also because I'm going to be too much time. We can go next. So this is an explanation of what we are going to put in the observatories and exploratories. This is a part that was designed in Italy, well, at least in a major part. And we are trying to find, a specific proposal for all the ingredient lists here. But I would like to go next, also to leave more time for questions, because it would be also interesting to see how you react to this presentation and maybe it's easier if I get specific questions. So this is about the global participatory platform, an open, inspired platform for everyone, with the goal of having more opportunities for social, economic, and political participation. We hope that, collecting a contribution and letting this platform to be seen as open we can help participation and convince people that we are doing a new kind of policymaking, a policymaking that really takes into account the views of everybody. So you can skip to the next. I guess is I think this is the last one. So the project is aiming to a coming era of social inspired innovations. Understanding social interactive system facilitates social inspired ICT. There are a lot of items that we are trying to work on, including, for example, I specifically work on trust and reputation, and there is an example here for a trustable web, reputation-based and self-regulating. And we hope that this effort could bring economic benefits and new solutions to societal problems. We are taking a step-by-step approach here. We are not thinking that it's possible, not even in 10 years, to produce a sensible long-term prediction about society. But what we hope is that joining forces together will help us to make a transition towards a society that is more participated and more planned than the society that we are having now, a society in which innovations can be tested, thanks to our simulator, before they're thrown in the wild without being able to understand what are the possible consequence, a society in which we have a set of observatories that tell us the signs of impending changes and impending crisis, so that we can try in a complex system way to issue new policies that help us move the complex system away from the crisis points, away from the tipping point. I'll conclude saying that there is, of course, a web page of the project. I have distributed, you will find them in the list of documents, a couple of a short leaflet and a long leaflet that will provide you with other material. And also, I'll put the link in the chat. There is a list of parties already involved, and there is also a page to join Future ICT as supporters. We need support if someone is sympathetic with the idea, because we are competing with, of course, with other five very important ideas. And, browse the website, download documents, and if you want to get involved, get involved. That's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thank you, Mario. Moving on, our next speaker is Ursula Kattner from NIST. She's going to discuss a new initiative entitled the Materials Genome Initiative, and in particular focus on the data standards needs. Ursula, are you there?
I am there.
You sound great.
Okay, so that's a kind of a different talk because I'm not talking about solving a problem. I'm talking about a problem. Essentially, the Materials Genome Initiative, and I'm skipping now to slide 2, addresses materials data. And materials are extremely complex, and so one way to deal with it is using models to deal with it, but that's also challenging because these materials are very often have many components and multiple phases, and the way a material looks depends also how it has been processed and handled. And just the two micrographs illustrate the same material but subjected to different processing, and it looks different, it behaves different. So that's where our modeling hopefully will come in to help. And when people are nowadays designing new materials, it's really like searching for the needle in a haystack. Like when you look at modern superalloys, you have, and now it's slide 3, have about 12 components. And if you take the current composition space and you explore whether changes in composition can improve the alloy, it becomes an almost insurmountable task. So the idea is with MGI and computational tools, you can finally have a tool that helps you to find the needle in the haystack. So last summer, the White House published a white paper with the Materials Genome Initiative that is aimed to address these problems. And for time's sake, I don't want to go into the detail. The paper can be found on the White House webpage. NIST has been charged to provide the, and now it's slide five, been charged to provide the measurement and standards infrastructure that's needed for the MGI, and we will work with everybody who has essentially an interest in that to have standards and tools for the interoperability of materials data, and we will take computer data as well as experimental data, and we also will work on linking the lengths and timescales that are addressed by different modeling tools. So essentially, it can become more an integrated effort. On slide six, the goal is kind of try to represent it in a graphical way. We have the data generation and storage tools on one side, and essentially the people who want to design a new material, they come essentially with materials performance criteria, and so they will use the entire tool chest of what things that are available to come up with a new material. So that's the ideal that we try, and it's kind of a circular process where you are optimizing the material to obtain the required properties. On slide seven, that's kind of another hierarchy to show the different length scales and time scales. And what I will focus in the rest of my talk is actually the box, the gray box at the bottom of the slide, and I will have the most emphasis on the purple box and the method that's used there is called CalFAT, which I show on slide eight. Essentially, CalFAT was originally developed for the calculation of phase diagrams, hence its name. And experimental phase diagram and thermochemical data were used to develop functions to represent the energies, and the minimization of these energies then results in reproduction of the phase diagram. So at that point, there's really not much gained, but the gain comes that you can combine descriptions of two-component systems to predict a three-component system. You can refine that. Then you can combine the three components to create four components and so on. And the beauty is that essentially you don't need to continue refining things after you've done the three-component systems. And so you actually can make predictions of a 12-component system by collecting the pertinent three-component information. And over the last decades, the original CalFAT has been expanded to also describe other phase property data. Most predominant is now diffusion, but now it's also including volume data and other property data. So I mentioned that originally experimental data were used on slide nine. It also shows that with other computational techniques like first principles or atomistic simulations, we can now obtain input data from these methods, and they can feed into the CalFAT method. On slide 10, essentially from the CalFAT method, going back now to the MGI, the needs are that we really need who have flexible and evolving repositories for both calculated and measured data. And one thing we realized pretty early that materials and crystal structures of the phases in these materials really need to be uniquely described so that you know what you are dealing with. It would be also useful to have repositories for the files that go into these computational methods. And from the first point, essentially, for the general community beyond CalFAT, it will be useful to have a general repository for materials data. At NIST, we decided to focus initially on the data that are needed for the development of the CalFAT descriptions because the data space is so enormous that you have to start in one corner. And slide 11 shows the linkage of the different quantities that can be used in CalFAT. So all the quantities that are listed in this tables are related to the Gibbs energy and can be derived by differentiation from the Gibbs energy. One exception is the property listed in the bottom row where additional information that's highlighted is needed and is coupled then with the Gibbs energy. So with that, essentially we have a series of database files that are listed in slide 12. So these can be actually one file or multiple files which are linked by the software, and they are called databases, but they are actually collections of functions. Slide 3 shows an example for thermodynamic files that are used with the CalFAT method. There is a description of the thermodynamics. It contains information for the elements, the phases, the reference dates. Ideally, it should also include the software and its version. It needs to have reference information, and if we have it on websites, ideally the person who put it there should also be listed, and then some auxiliary information. Another very important file are the experiment or the evaluated data files that contain the data. And in addition to the obvious information, it's also, again, very important that the source of the information is very well documented, and then there may be also auxiliary files that are essentially more for user convenience. And for that, we used file extensions that came from ThermoCalc, and they just are symbolizing the different kinds of files. I skip now to page 16. We have essentially two classes of data, single-phase data, multi-phase data, and that kind of may impact how they are stored, and we try to come up with a schema of the data or what's needed to describe one datum. And so we found it's actually a very lengthy list, but in practice many items will be blank. And we also found that we really need to distinguish with standalone data where one point has enough information or whether we have a data series where an individual datum taken out of that series doesn't make any sense at all. So the next steps for us is that we will develop a file repository for first principle calculations, one for CalFAT calculations, one for atomistic simulations is already in place, and then we will try to tackle a general data repository with a prototype repository, and for that we will evaluate several data storage formats, and hopefully that with IT experts, because so far my experience, material scientists usually are too naive when it comes to that. So that concludes my talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Ursula. Eden, are you on the line? Eden is from LexisNexis and is here to talk about some work that they've done in machine learning and how it relates to big data. Take it away, Eden.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Edin Muharremagic. I work for LexisNexis Risk Solutions Group, where I have been involved in very exciting company initiative or project. The initiative to basically build machine learning library that would work together with our HPCT platform. But before I start talking about HPCT platform, I wanted to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity basically to address this audience and talk about our HPCT system. The HPCT system was designed to help enterprises manage their big data at every step in the big data value chain. And what that means is that from getting an unstructured chunk of data to being able to see some results and make some sense of that data, data has to really go through a number of steps. And those steps are as follows. You have to be able to collect structured, unstructured, and semi-structured data from multiple sources. You then have to be able to ingest that data into a single data store. After data is stored, you have to have capability to do cleansing of that data. You have to be able to understand the format and content. Once this phase is done, you get into the integration process, data integration process, which is basically, which involves a linking of data records that you have available, entity extraction, entity resolution, indexing, data fusion, and similar things. Once data is in that shape, you should be able to do some analysis of that data, which covers intelligence, statistics, text analytics of data, and maybe application of machine learning that would produce some meaningful results and insight into that data. And finally, you should be able to deliver your results in a meaningful way, which means that you should be able to allow your customers or users of the system to specify what they want, usually in the form of some kind of queries, and then you would like to be able to produce results in visual form so that users would be able to make a lot of sense from the results that they receive. The machine learning library we have been building is very significant for data analysis component of this chain, as it should make it easier to basically explore big data and help us find patterns and non-obvious relationships in that data. So in this presentation, I wanted to talk about HPCT systems and its associated machine learning library that we have been building. This platform really represents a very powerful tool for big data exploration, and listening to other presenters today, I can see that much of the research that you have been involved in, really, if it involves big data, it requires appropriate tools that would basically make it easier for you to deal with that data. So I would hope that the information that I provide to you today will help you and me understand better how HPCT, together with machine learning library that we have developed, might help your research and how it might relate to the research associated with the ontology.
Eden, just as a reminder, if you could please call out the slide number and ask to advance the slides.
Yes. I was still on the slide number one, and we are moving to the
slide. Okay, well, we have
two.
To, you know, we have to end this call at 2:30, so
okay.
you don't have much time.
I understand. How much more time do I have?
Probably no more than 10 minutes.
Okay, that's good enough. Slide number two. So let me start by giving you a bit of background about LexisNexis Risk Solutions and the HPCC system. So LexisNexis Risk Solutions, this is an industry leader in data content, data aggregation, and information services. The company has independently developed and implemented a solution for data-intensive computing, and this platform is called HPCC, which is an acronym that stands for High Performance Computing Cluster. LexisNexis has been using this HPCC platform for its core business for more than 10 years, and basically it currently generates in excess of $1.4 billion. Dollars in revenue based on that platform. In June 2011, we have decided to release HPCC as an open source platform under the new name HPCC System. So HPCC System is designed to run on clusters of computers, and basically the idea is to allow for horizontal scaling of system so that you can leverage as many nodes that or parts of the cluster as possible. However, even though HPCC systems has been designed as a cluster, it can also be installed on a single machine or virtual machine for learning or test purposes, and this turned out to be very useful for users and customers. It is also important to point out that HPCC systems can run on Amazon Cloud, and to make it easier for people to use it in a cloud environment, we have created a service that we call Amazon One-Click Store, and that service basically allows you to specify your Amazon account and the number of nodes that you want in the cluster, and basically the cluster gets built for you automatically. Very important component of that is ECL language. And the most important feature of that language is basically that once you create or write the code in ECL, you can run that code on the cluster of any size. So basically what that means is that you would create a code, you can test it on a small cluster. If it turns out that your data has grown to be too big for the cluster of 10 nodes, you simply increase, build a cluster of larger size, and run the same code in that cluster. Next slide, slide number three. HPCC is fast, flexible, and highly scalable platform. It can be used on any data-centric task, and it can meet the needs of any database regardless of how big the database is. So in this diagram, we have a high level platform architecture that identifies individual components that basically build this cluster. The three most important components of this architecture are two clusters. One is called the Thor, which basically is data refinery cluster. And the responsibility of this cluster is to consume all the data that you have to deal with and basically process that data record by record in order to clean it up, link it, and get it ready for any other use. The second cluster that we have is associated with data delivery. So once you have ingested all the data and processed it appropriately and indexed it appropriately, you want to be able to access results quickly, and this is what data delivery cluster has been designed to do for you. And the third critical component, as I pointed out before, is ECL, Enterprise Control Language, which is powerful programming language, high-level language that has been designed to basically be very suitable for manipulation of big data. architecture involves additional components, and as well, you have middleware component that basically ties everything together, and you have a number of other auxiliary components that are necessary for the big platform of this type to function efficiently and correctly. Moving to the slide number 4. So basically, this slide outlines everything that I described with a diagram. I identified a couple of points that are important for each and every element, and I wanted to maybe take some additional time to talk about characteristics of the ECL language, which is very important for users of the platform. So ECL language is designed to be transparent and implicitly parallel programming language for data-intensive applications. What that means basically is that you write the code without even thinking about how big a cluster you want to run it on, and basically when you run it on any cluster size, parallelization of job takes under the cover and user doesn't have to be concerned about that at all. It is a high-level and highly optimized data-centric declarative language that allows programmers to define what data processing results should be and the data flow and transformations that are necessary to achieve that result. Unlike procedural languages, you do not actually define the steps to achieve a certain result. You define what your objective is, and the system basically does that efficiently for you. ECL also is extensible language, and basically you can build additional functionality into the language by extending it, developing code in C++ that either gets built as an embedded C code, or maybe it gets built as dynamically linked libraries that are accessible to the language itself. The language also has capabilities that have been designed to basically help natural language processing. It has parse capabilities and pattern statements, and this might actually be directly applicable to the ontology, which may need to do some kind of textual processing of big data files. Slide number 5. So we really have a platform and a high-level language that allows the system to be relatively easily used by customers. We wanted to make it even easier for customers to use to analyze the big data that they have, and that was the reason why we decided to create machine learning library that would work on that platform. But this machine learning library contains an extensible collection of machine learning routines, which are easy and efficient to use, and they are designed to execute in parallel across the cluster. So I have listed all the modules that we currently support, but this is an ongoing project, and we will be adding new functionality to the library as needed. So the question to ask would be, why would anyone need yet another machine learning library when a number of high-quality machine learning libraries and platforms such as SAS, Beka, Octave, MATLAB, they already exist? So the problem with those solutions is that they are single computer solutions, which means that they can scale only vertically, which means that basically you can throw in, you can buy more powerful computer, but when you're dealing with this with big data, then vertical scaling is not good enough. You have to have a system that scales horizontally as HPCCC platform does. We have collaboration with FAU, Florida Atlantic University, and one professor whose research interests are in data mining and machine learning. He told us that, for example, the experiments that he runs in the area of feature reduction, they take up to 6 months to complete. And he's struggling to get as many computing resources as possible, and then he manually splits his work across all those resources that he manages to get, and he's still, the job itself takes up to 6 months to complete. So this tells you that there is a huge need for a platform that would allow you to really scale horizontally, and if you have huge amount of big data to process, this platform should be able to accommodate that, and you do not need to basically do any manual work, and you don't need to worry about how to split that work across the node. This is where Amazon one-click storage service that I mentioned earlier could be a huge help, because if you have a problem, big data problem that you have to resolve, there is a service that you can rent on a temporary basis. You can run experiments that you need to run, get results, and basically disconnect from the Amazon and have your solution available. Next slide. This is a slide number 6. Another component of the system that is very significant is a capability to visualize results. And I just wanted to give you an example of visualization that our Roxy server was capable of producing. So just for demonstration purposes for this presentation, we have built an application that basically uses Wikipedia statistics data. And we collected data from Wikipedia, and we wanted to see the frequency of hits for specific pages, and then we normalized all those hits across all the pages within a period of 24 hours. And then we delivered that as a Roxy service, allowing customers or users of that data to specify what kind of page they would be interested in seeing the frequency of accesses for. So in this specific example, what we have done is that we requested frequency of hits for all pages associated with four different phones. And this is basically the result of the frequency of hits on those pages. Now, you really can draw a number of different conclusions based on the visual result that you can see here. The size of the circles actually represents the size of the number of hits. So you can see that, for example, BlackBerry's are being the BlackBerry website, Wikipedia website, is being hit most of the time. And you can see that Android users really were hitting Android pages in the same time ratio as BlackBerry users, and that can lead you to conclude that basically those requests are coming from the same geographic region and so on. So in any event, without going further into those details, visualization is very important because it allows you to make better conclusions based on the results that you have. Next slide, slide number 7. I have outlined here what is necessary for users to do if they wanted basically to be able to use machine learning functionality and algorithms on HPC systems. And as you can see here, you really need to configure and install HPC platform. You have to install all the tools. You have to familiarize yourself with the ECL programming language, and at the end, you should download and install a machine learning library and play with it, and hopefully the system itself will provide you enough help to help you basically advance your research. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eden. Peter, do you think we have time for a couple of questions?
Yes. Take another 5-10 minutes. Your call.
Okay. So if there are any questions, I think last time what we did is you raised your hand, and when you're acknowledged, you can go ahead and ask the question. Peter.
Just a quick one for Eden. Is the HPCC system that you're working on the sort of the same or the extension of the government-funded or HPCC initiatives dating back to the supercomputing era?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Oh. So
it is, let me qualify that. Could you clarify the question?
Peter, I think the HPCC initiative is the High Performance Computing initiative.
Right.
And so that was an initiative towards using high performance computing. I believe the LexisNexis solution is not related to that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Can I ask a question? I'm not on chat board.
Yes.
This is for the last speaker, Aidan. So have you done comparison? I'm Ravi Sharma. Have you done comparison with which one of the unsupervised or supervised clustering techniques works better in what kind of situation?
Well, our objective really was to provide the tools, and the assumption is that the users who need machine learning libraries would basically do experimentations, and they should and would decide what kind of algorithms to use and what algorithms would be most suitable for the results that they are trying to achieve.
So, for example, Mike Folk's work on Earth observations versus this, which is text processing, let's say, how would that work? Which ones you think would work better?
Well, I really am not too familiar with the research that has been presented today, so it's
okay.
Difficult for me to comment on that. But for example, if you need to have some kind of information extraction system, you can use components provided by HPCC and machine learning library to help in that respect. So you can use doc components to basically extract entity names, and then you can apply a variety of different classification algorithms to see whether and how you can classify or even maybe clustering. But again, I really cannot comment on that because I'm not familiar with the research.
I think that's an excellent question. Now, here at NIST, we've done some work in image-based analysis, and we've used some of the same techniques in processing cell images. We have a paper that's coming out that's entitled Towards a Recommendation System for Similarity. And when it gets published, I can forward a copy to the group.
I would really appreciate to get a copy from that. And what I would like to get out of this discussion would be maybe some kind of feedback. I would like to hear what you thought you could use HPCC for and how useful you think it would be for your research, and maybe suggestions about what you think is missing so that we can work on that part to make it actually more appropriate tool for research community to use.
The example that you showed was like for counts, because you're just looking at hourly fingerprint from Wikipedia on usage of phones, but it's really expression of a number, you know.
That's
like
right.
Number per unit period. While for image processing, I heard the comment, also maybe Mike can say more. It's really the features, reflection, topography, temporal variations, those in image pixels are a different kind of target a source format, source data. Everything, of course, is binary numbers these days.
Yes, and if I may address that quickly, so basically, that you, in machine learning, you really have two components to deal with. One is to vectorize a specific problem that you have. So if, for example, you would like to do some analysis of text, you would like to do some clustering of documents based on the content, the first step really is to use, for example, Docs component that we have as part of our machine learning library to vectorize, to tokenize the text, to associate numbers with specific words. And that, you can say, represents vectorization of that space. So once you do that, everything becomes numbers, and then you plug in those numbers into machine learning algorithms, and you get additional results. So along the same lines, for image processing, for example, you really extract features that represent the image, and those features, they represent vectors, and then you use those numbers in various variety of different algorithms.
Yes, but in text processing, one thing I have to be careful is whether I'm reading literature, law books, or scientific journals. So depending on that initial learning or vectorizing phase would give different results, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Definitely.
Okay. Thank you. I think we can carry on, but I think we were limited to 1 or 2 minutes. So I will stop at this. Mike has any comments?
No, what you say does make sense, and at our level, yeah, it's just all numbers. So that's a simple response to that.
Thank you.
Doug? Star 7 on mute.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm now unmuted. Yes, Mario was discussing using crowdsourcing and citizen science for a platform for everybody with a very open platform. It seems to me that something is needed to prevent people from fighting over, what is the science, because people have very different science and very different views of things. So how would you deal with an open sourced system when different people using the system totally disagree on things that are supposedly facts?
Mario, are you still with us?
Yes, sorry, I'm here. I hope you can hear me now. Can you?
Yes.
Great. So the answer is we really are fond of having this kind of world of modeling platform. One of its purpose is to have model reconciliation. So if several models are about the same phenomenon, they can, and it's good, have some kind of different predictions. But then by scaling them and by comparing them with other models, we hope we try to get consensus. Of course, this is about the simulations and our understanding of the model. It's not about reconciliations of divergences on what is real at a scientific datum in the world. We don't have a part on that, and perhaps we should think about it. But, also the possibility to use different models to predict different results, for example, in economy, I also think is a good way to attract the attention of people. And then if we are able to maintain the discussion on a good scientific level, we could also reach a kind of consensus. If not, it's again something in the hands of politics to be decided.
Okay.
Thank you, Mario.
Thank you. It seems Peter? Like it's more of a...
Oh, I'm sorry, Doug.
I was just saying it seems that the social issues here are going to make for problems unless you can close off different areas for different people, so different groups can have their own models and not be able to affect what somebody else's model is, which you would in an open system. I could modify your model and you could modify mine.
We're not really thinking of people modifying a model without, I mean, spawning a different model from it. So it's you can use my model and modify it, but then again, it's a competition between models to see which results fit better the data mining part and which results are, more or less plausible. In the end, for some issues, because, there are some technical, we are aware that you can't forecast more than immediate future unless you're really in a stable status. For some issues, it will be, again, just a matter of politics. So you can have conflicting results from conflicting models, and then it's a matter for the politicians to decide. So we think that leaving access open would be good. The competition, one ingredient that could help us is that there is some level of difficulty, technicality in writing a model, and we hope that people that take some effort in building such a system could be sincere and accept criticism and accept also results from other models. Of course, this can be just wishful thinking, but it's the approach that I think we will take.
Thank you.
Peter?
Yes, my question is for Dr. Kim, and I did type it out on the chat board as well. I noticed on your slide number 8, you did mention that the Japan experience with the shelter assessment system was up and running in 2 weeks. I assume, for all of us, systems people, that was really good. And obviously in a disaster situation, that may not be as good as one would think. But overall, were there assessment on how effective the systems cited in your use cases worked out in real life? Are there published metrics and reports that one could actually go look at and learn from the exercise?
In our systems, especially we think about the time the shelter in the shelter there need many people need the water and then some the other stuff, the edited information, but it's a little difficult to gather some what they need to survive. At the time, some people using the social network to publish this. We need some, for example, the food or the water. So that's why we very big issue to using some social network to get the real situation information. So is that okay to for your questions?
Right, thank you. Maybe one more question. Of course, yeah. All these things, the ability for the system to function and the users to access them predicates on the availability of the infrastructure. And in a disaster like this, when the infrastructure is destroyed or damaged, nothing else matters, really. Did that actually come into play?
Yes.
In a strong way, because you obviously would depend on the internet or the cell phone infrastructure and so on.
Yes, actually, is infrastructure very important? So, but the cell phone, the network are really difficult to the using the, our systems, but the, especially it, our institute has some big test bed of the network systems to cover the whole area of the Japan. So we first start to test the, using the, our network infrastructure. Then we want to involve the, some other, actually the commercial companies to the, join our the work. And then we also try to the, connect the, some Docomo. The company is one of the Japan's companies. So we are, yeah, it, we started to discuss the, some, the, this kind of the application now.
Well, thank you. And thank you very much for your presentation. It was extremely interesting.
Thank you.
Back to Mary.
Are there any more questions? I don't see anyone's hands raised. Eden, if you're still on the line, there's one that showed up on the chat. I don't know that you're on the chat room. Matthew had asked what open source products you're using.
What open source product?
Yes. Just your own, right? But you might want to clarify that.
Yes, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Matthew, would you like to restate the question?
I'm building something very similar to what you and actually Mario are building out. And it's all open source, and I was just wondering if you're using any open source products that are basically on the market, or is this open source in which you have created that you have designated open source? Just like to have that clarified.
Yes, I understand the question now. I apologize, I didn't understand it before. So basically, the company LexisNexis has created that high performance computing cluster some maybe 10 years ago. And has mm-hmm. created a business around it. That was a proprietary technology that gave the company a competitive advantage on the market. In June 2011, we have decided to basically make this solution available to the community in the form of open source. So basically we open sourced our solution and made it available to everyone. And it is not that we are using anyone else's open source solution as part of that. We simply decided to open up our proprietary solution and make it available to the world.
Okay. One quick question. Are you familiar with the open source products of Scilab and R? And how does those two products compare to yours, if you're familiar with them?
I am not familiar with them.
Okay, that's fine.
So I'm familiar with R, and the one difference that I see is that the HPCC solution is built to take advantage of a clustered environment. So it's already configured to make use of additional nodes.
Oh, I see. So the functionality is there, but the performance, like the high-performance computing infrastructure.
And I'm not so familiar with R that I know all the machine learning algorithms and how many of them are available. But
yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. If I may add a little bit of clarification here, I have tried to point that out in my presentation. The idea of HPCC system is really that this is a horizontally scalable system. So basically what that means is that if you have the bigger the problem you have, you can throw bigger cluster at that problem without having to worry about how to use those additional resources that you are making available to the system. So everything is associated with parallelizing your algorithms and using all the resources available by the cluster. Everything is done for you under the cover. So you simply just call the function and underlying system distributes that across the nodes, and the expectation is that you would basically have the solution that scales linearly with the number of nodes.
Okay, great. Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. I'd like to thank all of the speakers for your time today. I think it's been a very engaging and interesting set of topics and gives us a lot to think about in terms of how we can pose a challenge in big data. But I'd like to thank all the participants today, and I look forward to next week.
See you all next week.
Alrighty, thank you.
Bye-bye.